From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, what it means to be home. What makes you feel at home? And with changes in immigration, fighting for your right to stay in your home.
I'm tired to not have no paper. I do everything right here, like pay my taxes, buy my house. When I went to the home security, they arrested me.
And it's been over a year since Brazil legalized same-sex marriage.
This town is very machista. It's difficult for people to accept this kind of relationship. How I see it, we all have the same rights in the eyes of God and everyone. But that's not what most people think.
Also, the GOP reacts to President Obama's immigration actions. Mariachis find a home in Alaska. And we hear about your Latino Thanksgiving traditions. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. I first talked to Jacobo Gabriel Tomas the day before he was supposed to be deported.
Okay, I'm here in Worthington, Minnesota.
Worthington is about 3 hours southwest of Minneapolis. Jacobo describes it as a mixed community, Latinos and white Americans. Jacobo himself is originally from Guatemala, but he's lived in the U.S. for 22 years. After coming here as a legal refugee during Guatemala's civil war.
I feel like I'm born here, but actually I'm not.
Jacobo works on a pig farm. He has 5 children, 4 with his wife Isabel.
Daryl,
and how old is Daryl?
13. Beatrice, and she's 11. And Alvin, he's 10. And Daisy, she's 6 years old.
Overall, seems like a pretty typical life in the exurbs. But his latest trouble started after a recent traffic stop. Jacobo said a cop said something had been moving in his back seat, ran his records, and found a previous deportation order. The cop told him to show up at Homeland Security's office. But Jacobo thought he could prove that he had been a good citizen. He was ready.
I'm tired to not have no paper. I do everything right here, like pay my taxes, buy my house. When I went to the Home Security, they arrested me.
When you went to Homeland Security, I'm ready to present myself. I want to become legal. And then they arrested you?
Yes.
Today on Latino USA, we're bringing you stories about home, what makes it, and what happens when you're threatened with losing it.
In Jacobo's case, he's been here almost 22 years. He's been a homeowner for 8 years, has paid his taxes in the United States for, I think, about 13 years.
That's Kathy Close, Jacobo's lawyer and an attorney at the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. Just the day before he was scheduled to leave, Jacobo retained her as his lawyer. From all appearances, it didn't seem like Jacobo would be someone the government would prioritize for deportation. He's had a few traffic offenses, has worked using false papers, like many, if not most, undocumented working people. But that seems to be it. The local Immigration and Customs Enforcement office in St. Paul didn't want to go on tape, but they had this to say about Jacobo's case in early November.
Although not in ICE custody, he is pending imminent removal from the United States. As a former fugitive with a final order of deportation, Mr. Gabriel Tomas's case falls within ICE enforcement priorities.
About that word, fugitive. After coming here as a legal refugee, Jacobo had been told previously that once the Civil War was over, it would be time to go home. But Guatemala wasn't home anymore. By that time, he had 2 kids. He'd built a life in Minnesota. ICE also told Latino USA that just because people like Jacobo aren't a quote-unquote priority doesn't mean they won't get deported. Come the morning of November 5th, Jacobo readied himself and went to meet with ICE.
Then they say, here's your passport, then here's sheet for deportation sheet. So then it's up to you if you want to leave or if you want to stay. Just let us, your officer know. And I said, what?
The ICE agent actually seemed to be offering him a choice whether to stay or go.
Then I was scared or sad to they can go arrest me and arrest my wife. So that's why I was thinking, so probably it's better to leave. So I went to airport, then I fly to Texas.
At this point, back in early November, President Obama had been promising to take action on immigration for a while. The midterms had been held the day before, and some kind of action by the president was looking increasingly likely.
Deportation, education on deportation, education on deportation.
Immigration reform activists pushed pretty hard for parents of dreamers and other people in the country without papers, especially parents. President Obama has pushed back against this expansion of deferred action in the past. Here he is in September of 2013 on Telemundo.
Young people who have basically grown up here are Americans that we should welcome. We're not going to have them operate under a cloud, under a shadow. But if we start broadening that, then essentially I would be ignoring the law.
But earlier in November, a dreamer interrupted President Obama at a rally.
And I give you relief administratively, and we're going to work on the next one.
So with the president promising action on immigration reform before the end of the year, it seemed to Kathy Close, his lawyer, that Jacobo should stay and fight. But he had already gotten on a plane from Minneapolis. So they paged him at the Dallas airport before he could board his connecting flight to Guatemala.
He was under the impression if he left, and then if something changed in the immigration laws or if the president would announce some executive action, I think the family thought they might be able to come back and at that time take advantage of something. And so we had the talk with him that now is the time to, if there's any hope for your future of staying together as a family.
And when I hear that, so I say, okay, it's so proud. It's a lot better to go back, see if there's another opportunity.
Jacobo made his way back home to Minnesota, catching a bus and then begging $10 for a fare from a total stranger. We caught up with him a few days after he had returned. His lawyer had already filed for Jacobo's case to be reviewed by the National ICE Office and tried to get his deportation deferred. Then, just a few days later,
we're going to keep focusing enforcement resources on actual threats to our security. Felons, not families. Criminals, not children. Gang members, not a mom who's working hard to provide for her kids.
It appears that Jacobo's case is likely to pan out. For now, at least, he'll probably be able to stay in the country. Here's Kathy Close.
No, we're very, very excited about this announcement and how it could impact Jacobo. We believe he is eligible for the expanded deferred action program. So it appears from at least the initial information that came out that he should be eligible for this.
The new memo released by Jay Johnson, Homeland Security Secretary, mostly supersedes previous similar memos. It's a bit technical, and we'll have a link to it on latinousa.org. But for now, Jacobo's deportation doesn't seem to be a priority. But deferred action is just that, an act not taken. There's no permanent solution to Jacobo's case until Congress puts together legislation. If it weren't for his kids, one of whom could eventually file a petition for him to stay once they're old enough, there probably wouldn't be a plan to allow him to stay permanently at all. And the ball seems to be in the Republican-controlled Congress's court, at least for the next 2 years. If there's one place where Obama's executive action on immigration didn't sit well, it was with Republicans in Congress. They feel the president ruined any compromise on immigration by going solo. House Majority Leader John Boehner.
With this action, the president has chosen to deliberately sabotage any chance of enacting bipartisan reforms that he claims to seek.
We decided to take a look at how prominent Latinos in the Republican Party reacted to the president's measures and how their opinions square with Latino voters. Republican Representative Raul Labrador, member of the House Judiciary Committee, said this about the president's executive action.
He was supposed to be a president who wanted to unify the country, and instead he's trying to divide the country, and I think that's going to be his legacy.
But his view on the president's action is mostly out of line with Latino voters. According to a survey by the polling firm Latino Decisions, made right after the president's announcement, a whopping 89% of Latino registered voters supported the president's executive action on immigration. In fact, 2 out of 3 Latino voters would support more executive action if Congress doesn't act on immigration reform. Senator and Tea Party leader Ted Cruz went a step further. He wants the incoming Republican majority to block presidential nominees and cut funding for agencies that implement Obama's executive measures.
Then it's incumbent on Republicans in Congress to use every single constitutional tool we have to defend the rule of law, to rein in a president so that the president does not become an unaccountable monarch.
But Republicans may not be able to afford that backlash, at least not with Latinos. According to surveys by Pew and Latino Decisions, a majority of Latinos blame immigration inaction on Republicans in Congress. And from that same Latino Decisions poll, Latinos oppose Republican efforts to block the president's actions on immigration, and that includes 60% of Latino voters who identify as Republicans. And then there's Nevada's newly reelected Republican governor, Brian Sandoval, who's moderated his stance on immigration in order to make significant inroads with Nevada's Latino voters. Governor Sandoval called on Congress and Obama to work toward a bipartisan solution. But as we've heard earlier, that seems unlikely, and Republicans could bear the cost with Latino voters.
There is a significant problem for Republicans in the Latino community, but I think it's a fixable problem.
That's Republican strategist Whit Ayers. He laid out what it takes for Republicans to do better with Latino voters.
If we support responsible immigration reform, if we campaign in Latino neighborhoods, if we advertise on Latino media, I think it's a fixable problem.
The next big battle will be the 2016 presidential election.
I think that most of the Republican candidates for president in 2016 will support some version of immigration reform that fixes the broken system.
But what kind of reform? In his statements on the president's actions, Republican senator and possible presidential candidate Marco Rubio said he favors an immigration reform that secures the border and fixes legal immigration first. But Pew and Latino Decisions polls show that 3 out of 4 Latinos favor some form of legal status for undocumented immigrants. In any case, campaigning on, quote, self-deportation, like Mitt Romney did in 2012, will probably not be an option for Republicans if they want to win the White House in 2016. Coming up on Latino USA, love them or hate them, having a home means having neighbors, and you gotta live with them.
People don't remember nothing.
Wait, you don't remember hitting my car?
No, no.
How can you forget hitting somebody's car?
That's coming up. No se vayan.
Baby. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all. On the web at rwjf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Having a home also means having neighbors. And just like with our relatives, we don't usually have a lot of choice about who our neighbors are. Eve Abrams tells us how a problem with one neighbor ended up turning into a friendship.
For about 5 years, I lived on a wide four-lane street in downtown New Orleans, just a few miles downriver from the French Quarter. The street is kind of a dividing line between white and black, gentrified and not, what flooded in Katrina and what didn't. I lived in a beautiful, crumbly old shotgun built in the late 1800s. The gingerbread out front was painted green and yellow. And standing underneath it, I could see a group of Latino guys hanging out a few doors down on the porch of an abandoned house, kicking back with music and sometimes barbecuing after a long day working with their hands. There was a dollar store across the street, two corner stores where you could buy a six-pack and a po' boy, a U-Haul, and a tire repair shop. But this story begins in the backyard I shared with my neighbors, where I had a garden and a grapefruit tree. I was out back hanging up my laundry when my neighbor Monique ran out of her house. "Someone just hit your car," she yelled. I had a broken front light, a smashed wheel bed, and a scrape of blue paint. Who would do this and drive away? Up the block, my neighbor Rudy was sitting on his steps. And I asked him, "Did he see anything?" Rudy said, "Yeah, I know who did it. I know the guy. He's a friend of mine." Rudy couldn't remember his name, but he said he was tall and bald and drove a blue truck. Rudy said the guy was Mexican, but he looked white, and that he hung out at the Shell station down the street. Rudy asked me not to say it was him who told me. I promised I wouldn't.
Fernando, can you describe what happened when I drove up at the gas station?
No, I don't want to remember because you're crazy, man. You're crazy. You're crazy, baby. The first time when we see you drive your truck, zoom!
Fernando said he thought I was Spanish.
I think it's Spanish.
And that I was pretty.
Está bonita. Me think it quick.
But then he saw my face.
Pero you're looking
and I started screaming.
Hey! I mean, understand and say, because no remember nothing.
Wait, you don't remember hitting my car?
No, no.
How can you forget hitting somebody's car?
No, because somebody say, hey, bro.
Fernando says a friend called him and told him he hit my car.
What? No, you stupid, man. Oh, for real, man. No. No, me saying no because no.
How could you not notice? Didn't you hear it?
No, yeah, no, Liz, no. No, it means no, zzz, no.
You didn't feel it?
Nothing. Me.
Were you borracho?
You see, yeah, borracho.
Drunk. Fernando was drunk when he hit my car.
Monique, this is Fernando. He's the guy who hit my car.
Hi.
He didn't even know that he hit the car, he said.
Oh, my God, it was so loud, I could hear it in my house.
Oh, yeah?
I could hear it.
And we don't understand nothing.
From inside, yeah.
Why you not? Hey! Why you not?
I ran out.
It's all right. Gone. It's fine.
You can tell. Fernando and I became friends. We talked about life in Mexico and here in the United States. Fernando even had a good friend of his, a cop, call me and tell me I could trust him. He paid me some money to fix the car, but I didn't want to take too much because I know how hard he worked. Fernando paints houses for a living, and we agreed that to pay off the rest of the money to fix the car, he'd help me paint the house around the corner my husband and I had just bought. When it was all over, I walked down the block to thank Rudy for being such a good neighbor. He said,
"He was going to talk to you anyway, you know."
He was?
Yeah. And maybe the day he was kind of scared because he was drinking beer.
He's your friend, right?
Yeah, he's my friend.
So why'd you tell me?
Before I met him, I met you. It's been like 4 years, we were friendly here, you know. Tell me who. Who talked to you?
This is Fernando again.
It's not important.
Tell me.
No.
It's important for me.
No. I'm not going to tell you.
Baby, you know...
It's not important. No importante.
What is important are people like Rudy, Monique, and Fernando. I need my car to get around, but I need my neighbors to get by. For Latino USA, I'm Eve Abrams in New Orleans.
Thanksgiving is a time when Americans go home. But we know each family's traditions are really different. Our producer, Antonia Cerejido, reached out on social media to you, our dear listeners, to see what your family does for Thanksgiving. El Día de Acción de Gracias. The way we say it in Spanish.
It's so intense. My family calls it Día del Pavo. Much simpler.
Antonia, what came up about Thanksgiving and Latinos?
So people sent us a bunch of stuff, mostly recipes, which was very exciting. Some really interesting fusion recipes, but also some very sweet testimonials about what their family does and what Thanksgiving means to them.
Cool. Let's listen.
This clip comes to us from Patty Kinich. She's a chef, a cookbook author, and the host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS.
So I marinate the turkey in an adobo in the style of the Yucatan. Lots of warm and flavorful spices like oregano, cumin, cinnamon. And then I sear it on a bed of tomatoes and red onion, stuff it with a mix of cornbread, pecans, Mexican chorizo, and tart apples. And then I wrap the whole ensemble in fragrant banana leaves.
Oh my God. No. Eso suena como cochinita pibil. But what I don't think I would eat that for Thanksgiving.
I think it sounds amazing. I would have that for Thanksgiving.
You're so happy. You're like, I want that now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? I got my turkey in the fridge and I'm going to go cover it in butter, salt and pepper.
All right. So up next, we have Jessica Mazon. She's a blogger in Texas and she's going to tell us about her Tejano Thanksgiving.
We used to have turkey with dressing, cornbread stuffing, very Southern. In addition to, you know, barbacoa. I mean, we had literally had cow's head as part of our Thanksgiving traditional dinner.
Oh, I love that. Oh, that's the best. Oyeme. I mean, that you don't get more kind of Tex-Mex or Mexicano than having a cow's head barbacoa in the middle of your kitchen table. Yep.
And our last clip is from Beto Mesta. He's a farm worker attorney in El Paso and the Texas editor for Pocho.com.
My family's Thanksgiving centered on mi mamá's red chili mole con pollo. We didn't have a turkey for lack of money. My parents are immigrants from Zacatecas, Mexico. My mother worked at a garment factory making jeans for a piecemeal rate. The company gave every employee a frozen turkey for Thanksgiving. Our refrigerator's freezer was cleared to make space for the frozen turkey. However, the turkey was only housed temporarily, so it was going to be given to more assimilated members of our extended family, who adopted the turkey and all the trimmings while watching the Dallas Cowboys play on Thanksgiving. Around 6 in the evening, the red chili mole was ready. Mi papá would lead us in grace, giving thanks to having the family together, which had grown to include nietos, yernos, and nueras. And I gave thanks to my parents that they immigrated to the United States and provided me with this unique Thanksgiving.
See, that's the cool thing about Thanksgiving is that it doesn't, you know, if you eat the turkey, órale, but if you eat enchiladas, that's beautiful too.
And I love how he talks about that they gave all the workers these frozen turkeys that meant nothing to them. I mean, this story is beautiful because it also encompasses like the diversity of the Latino experience, a very complete and beautiful homey story.
Well, and in the end, Thanksgiving is all about home, so I hope that everybody had a really great holiday. Salon day before a big wedding. Hair, nails, mini sandwiches, cake and champagne. The typical preparations before you say, I do. But this wedding isn't so typical, and neither is the couple. Sabrini Benitez and Solange Ramirez are young Brazilian lesbians who signed up to get hitched just 1 year after gay marriage was legalized in Brazil. Reporter Alexandra Hall tells us how they challenged tradition in gaucho country.
The lone horseman who once roamed the pampas of South America, living off the land, at one with nature, he's gone. But a traditionalist movement in southern Brazil keeps his spirit alive. There's no stronger place to see it than here in Santana do Livramento, a city of 100,000 on the border with Uruguay. Eloir Rodriguez is one of those people who's trying to keep gaucho tradition kicking. You can tell from his serious belt, big silver buckle, and the puffy gaucho pants he tucks into his tall leather boots. Tonight, Eloir is hosting a community event. A band plays on stage, men stand by the bar drinking beer, and little girls run by in colonial dresses.
What does it mean to be gaucho? I would say it's preserving the customs of gauchos. Traditional dance, throwing the lasso, riding horses, the rodeo, the songs.
But it's not just a horse and lasso that makes you a gaucho. If you want to walk the gaucho walk, talk the gaucho talk, Eloir says, be a manly man.
The gaucho is different. He's macho. When people talk about the gaucho, they're talking about the masculine gaucho.
As for gaucho women,
you won't see a nice young lady here with tattoos, with piercings, or any of those things. It's different here. That's not how we do things.
That's why in this town, two women coming to the altar is hard for people to swallow. Here at the salon, 26-year-old Sabrini Beniches and 24-year-old Solange Jamirez are getting ready for their wedding. The two are so nervous, all they can do is laugh.
I hit on her. I threw myself in front of her motorcycle and said, "What beautiful eyes you have. What a beautiful smile you have." I saw before that she was looking at me. She said that she knew me, and I said, "Yeah, we already kissed once." She said that we hadn't, but I kept saying that we did. We went on like that, and that's how we got together.
Sabrini and Solange have been together for almost 5 years. When Brazil legalized same-sex marriage 1 year ago, they decided to make it official.
The important thing was to get married. It didn't matter where. I think that when you make a decision and your friends and family support you, that's the important part. Just move forward and be happy.
But not everybody was happy when their wedding went public. Legalizing gay marriage in Brazil may have changed what it means to be a family on paper, but that didn't instantly transform everyday life in rural parts of the country, where conservative gender roles are rooted in centuries of tradition.
The traditional gaucho movement's interpretation of a family entity is limited to a father, a mother, and their children. They haven't allowed unions of persons of the same sex into the category of family.
34-year-old Judge Karini Labres considers herself just as gaucho as anybody else around here. But she says the law is the law.
As a judge, I cannot differentiate between the celebration of a marriage between heterosexual couples and homosexual couples.
But other people do differentiate. At a nearby park, surrounded by open-door evangelical churches, public opinion is mostly opposed to same-sex marriage.
The thing is that it's not appropriate around children. It doesn't set the right example. The child that's born in the home of a same-sex marriage, it's almost 100% likely that he's going to end up the same.
This town is very machista. It's difficult for people to accept this kind of relationship. How I see it, we all have the same rights in the eyes of God and everyone, but that's not what most people think.
My opinion is that if God made man and a woman, two people of the same sex together, is absurd, but the law of man is not the law of God. That's what I think.
Group weddings are common in Brazil. When Sabrini and Solange's wedding was announced as part of a group ceremony earlier this year, 7 gaucho community centers jumped to volunteer their space. But when they found out same-sex couples would participate, local traditionalists called an emergency meeting. The next day, all but one of the community centers revoked their offers. The only guy who wouldn't budge was Gilbert Shepa Gisler.
Everyone is equal before the law, and everyone deserves respect, white, black, homosexual. Prejudice and discrimination are unacceptable.
Then Shepa himself became the target. He received a death threat by phone. He didn't take it too seriously until just 2 days before the wedding. In the middle of the night, someone had set fire to Shepa's community center. The police said a Molotov cocktail started it. The back wall had caught fire and the roof had collapsed, leaving charred plywood and a mess of melted white plastic chairs. Shepa said this isn't the gaucho way.
This can't happen again. This can't happen. They can't win. Because if we just leave it like this and simply accept it, what will become of this world?
That's when Judge Karini Labres stepped in. She moved the ceremony to her office at the Municipal Court of Santana do Livramento and personally paid the bill for the celebration.
As of tomorrow, this courthouse will be temporarily converted into a gaucho community center. We will bring the flag and hang it in here. Our mission is to dignify these families before the state and protect them. That's why we will use the House of Justice, which does not and never will discriminate. It's a shame that the local community has reacted in this way, because it demonstrates that we still have a lot to learn. We need to learn to tolerate.
On the day of the wedding, couples arrive by car, on foot, and in horse and buggy. Some are in their gaucho Sunday best. Solange wears a strapless white gown, white gloves, and sparkling flowers in her long dark hair. Sabrini is in a sharp black smoking jacket. They kiss, and Sabrini proudly waves the marriage contract in front of their guests. There's one special guest in the crowd, José Antonio San Juan Cataneo. 12 years ago, Cataneo dressed up as a character he called Captain Gay in a traditional gaucho parade and was severely beaten. He says that now, times may be starting to change, slowly, starting with this wedding.
El movimiento nacionalista gaucho es como una religión.
The traditional gaucho movement is like a religion with its own God and unwritten rules. It creates these situations of intransigence, intolerance, and criminality that puts at risk the lives of people who step out of line.
Gaucho culture is a fantasy, Captain Gay says, but one day he thinks the fantasy will be unmasked. For Latino USA, I'm Alexandra Hall in Santana do Livramento, Brazil.
Coming up on Latino USA, the magic of mariachi and how it found a home in Alaska.
It's just like when you're playing it, it plays right. And, you know, there's a whole community of people out there who recognize these songs from, like, their own childhood. And they hear that and they're like, this is awesome. This is a mariachi group.
Stay with us. No se vayan. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And American Jewish World Service, working in developing countries to end poverty and advance human rights. Information available at ajws.org.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Mariachi music conjures up images of Mexico, but one mariachi band is building a buzz in an unlikely place, thousands of miles away, and it's helping to create a new image for what's sometimes called the last frontier. Brooke Binkowski reports from Anchorage, Alaska.
It's a warm night, and a group of young people are sitting in a circle in a small room, tuning up their instruments. The band practices in an industrial part of town, in a space that doubles as a photography studio. It's 10 at night, but the sun's still shining through the window because it's summertime in Alaska. This is Mariachi Agave Azul, Alaska's only dedicated mariachi band. 16-year-old Javier Acuña is one of its singers. His family's from Mexico, but he was born here in Alaska.
It's a lot of like the Latino population here in Alaska, and a lot of them, when they first see us, they're like, are we really seeing this? Is this really happening? Like a little piece of home.
The music's a way the band is making Alaska home, too. Even the name combines the two places. Agave Azul means blue agave. Blue for Alaska's ice and ocean, agave for Mexico's famous plant, the source of tequila.
The rest of people are so interested, just like that the fact that they actually have mariachis here, but with actual Latino families, they're so happy to see us because it's a piece of their culture back here in Anchorage.
Alaska is one of the most diverse states in the nation. More than 90 languages are spoken in Anchorage alone. That diversity spiked during the recession. People came from everywhere, drawn mainly by oil and fishing jobs in the state's military bases. Then, they stayed. Sociologist Chad Farrell has been studying the state's demographics at the University of Alaska for years.
Here in Anchorage, the diversity has actually been accelerating faster than the United States, primarily driven by the growth in the Latino population, Asian Pacific Islander population, and then the biracial, multiracial people who identify as a multi-ethnic identity.
As of 2010, Latinos are the fastest-growing minority group in the state. For those who are immigrants, it can be faster to adjust legal status here than in most other states because there are fewer people. And because Alaska is so far from Mexico, border issues aren't as present as they would be elsewhere. According to the census, Alaska's Mexican-American population has almost doubled in the past 10 years, to 6%. That means the demand for Mariachi Agave Azul is growing. They've got regular gigs and fans all over Alaska. Its 13 members are young, all under 25, and only about half of them are of Mexican descent. The rest reflect Alaska's varied ethnicities. Take trumpeter Mark Williams.
My personal heritage is like African-American. And as far as like while I play with the band or while I play out in the community, I haven't gotten like any negative feedback about it.
William says the band's love for the music speaks for itself. It kind of reflects Alaska's own tolerance for people from different communities.
Race doesn't matter, gender doesn't matter, age doesn't matter. It's just like when you're playing it, it plays right. And, you know, there's a whole community of people out there who recognize these songs from like their own childhood. And they hear that and they're like, this is awesome. This is a mariachi group.
The music helps convey their cultural identity to other people. Singer Bea Acuña is the youngest member of the band. She's just 12.
Mariachi music, it's really upbeat, and I really love it so much. Even though when I was little, ever since my dad was playing it, I was like, oh, turn it down. I'm really getting sick of it.
After a while, she grew to embrace the tradition herself, and now she's happy to share it.
I get it now, that sometimes if you have something held up but you can't say it, sing it.
The band's working on its next generation as well. Two of its musicians are having a baby together. He's Mexican-American and she's Scandinavian-American. They say their child will be all Alaskan. For Latino USA, I'm Brooke Binkowski in Anchorage, Alaska.
Well, they say that home is where the heart is, but it's also where the stomach is. And for many recent immigrants, it's hard to feel at home when they can't find the food they're used to. But it can also be hard to stay healthy. Our producer, Antonia Cerejido, breaks down a new study that looks at what immigrant Latina women think of as healthy food and where they like to shop for it.
Okay, hi guys.
Hola a todos, ¿cómo están?
So today we're talking about dark leafy greens like these guys here.
I am standing amid dozens of women and a couple of men in poofy jackets and unwieldy scarves. We are all trying to huddle under a tarp on a brisk November day. We're at a cooking class that's happening at the 175th Street Green Market, a farmer's market in Washington Heights, New York City. Jesus Nunez is in the crowd. She's the mother of 12 and an immigrant from the Dominican Republic.
Yo compro más las ensaladas acá que en el supermercado porque en el supermercado siempre está maltratada, fea, no me gusta.
She says she doesn't buy salad at the supermarket because the greens taste bad. Instead, she comes all the way from the Bronx to do her shopping here at the farmer's market. She likes how fresh the produce is.
Me encanta todo lo fresco.
Sí. Researchers and politicians sometimes refer to areas where it's hard to find fresh food as food deserts.
Neighborhoods where either because of a lack of supermarkets or because of the poor quality of the produce that is in the small grocery stores, if you wanted to eat a salad or vegetables or fruit, you would have a difficult time doing so.
That's Andrew Rundle, a researcher at Columbia University. Andrew and fellow researchers noticed that there were many studies and policies aimed at solving this problem of food deserts, but it seemed like they were missing key information to solving it.
It's odd if you read the entire literature on this topic. There are almost no studies where people have actually just sat down with immigrant families and asked them what they want or what they believe is healthy food.
In other words, policies and programs have been rolling out to help these immigrant communities, but nobody had bothered to talk to them. Jesus told me that she prefers when her food is green.
They talked about food in terms of it being close to the source, kind of like farm-to-table food was really what they valued. And so farmers markets were exactly the kind of places that they would like to buy food from.
A lot of what they were saying sounds like popular foodie trends. Local food, organic produce with no pesticides.
It is this sort of intriguing idea that wealthier U.S.-born families are going to places like Whole Foods to buy farm-to-table vegetables and greens and locally sourced meats that are labeled with the farm that they came from, when this idea is also a very traditional idea of going to your local market that was supplied by your local farms.
The women interviewed didn't just prefer fresh produce, they also preferred fresh meat.
I was surprised by how often they referred to buying meat at slaughterhouses in New York City. I never really understood that there are actually lots of small slaughterhouses in New York City where you can get fresh chickens, goat, and rabbit.
In New York City, there's roughly 80 slaughterhouses, according to the New York Daily News. These slaughterhouses are also known as viveros, a much gentler Spanish word. There's actually one a few blocks away from our offices. So one afternoon, I decided to check it out. That cackle belongs to Maria Colon. She's been working at the vivero for 5 years, and it was a natural fit since she raised chickens in her backyard back in the Dominican Republic. She explains to me that customers come in and actually pick out the chicken that they want.
La gente te dice qué tipo de gallina quiere o solo dice quiere una gallina.
No, qué tipo, ellos quieren, ellos eligen.
Dame esa, dame esa, dame.
She says all kinds of people come to get their meat at the vivero.
Ecuadoriano, Mexicano.
Ecuadorians, Mexicans.
Africano.
Africans.
Americano también.
Even Americans. Maria takes me to the back room, where things get real, where the actual slaughter happens.
Okay, now, oh my god, oh my god. Now it's like a dryer where they're taking away all of the feathers. And you see like the little feet coming out of the top of the bin. This is intense.
It's not for the faint of heart. But talking to the customers, their reasons for buying their meat at the slaughterhouse make a lot of sense.
La carne está más suave y está más amarillita.
Maria Hernandez says the meat is softer and more yellow. She isn't talking about convenience. She's talking about taste, color, flavor. For some immigrants, moving to the U.S. means a drastic change in diet due to a phenomenon known as dietary acculturation.
This idea is essentially that when an immigrant family comes to the United States, they initially come with their home country food practices. And then as time goes by, they start to eat more and more like an American and as a result gain weight.
It's easier to preserve their prior and most likely healthier diet if they live in an area with a greater population of immigrants.
You could imagine that if you're an immigrant and you moved into an immigrant neighborhood, there are people around you who have similar values to you. There's also the economic support for the kinds of stores and markets that sell food and products from your home country that would be absent in a neighborhood that's predominantly U.S.-born.
This could be part of why Vivedos and farmers markets are popular with immigrants. They remind immigrants of the food markets in their native countries. But government action doesn't seem to take this into account. New York City recently released a program called Fresh that aims to bring more supermarkets to these supposed food deserts.
Supermarkets might be part of the picture of improving the food market, but we also think that farm-to-table programs such as community-supported agriculture, support for farmers markets, is another positive investment that could be made in neighborhoods to improve diet and nutrition.
So there isn't just one way out of a food desert. Trying alternative or new paths might be fruitful. For Latino USA, I'm Antonia Cerejido. Corazón de melón, de
melón, 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 melón. Corazón. Our intern, Laura Calzada, contributed reporting to this piece. Melón, melón, melón. Corazón. And now for our sabiduría, or words of wisdom. We've been talking about home today on our program, what makes home, what takes us away from home. And we wanted to explore the idea of making a home for yourself when you're feeling unwelcome. For some people, that means dealing with racism, even in a church, and tackling that racism head on. Here's Reverend Marisol Caballero, an assistant minister at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin.
Unitarian Universalism is a very white denomination. It's white not only in its demographic makeup, but also culturally. A person who isn't white, a person of color, Latino, Latina, when they walk in the door, it's noticeable. You have a room full of majority white liberals who like to think of themselves as very open-minded, very progressive. They will ask questions of me like, what part of Mexico were you born in? Or they'll say, the age-old question that all people of color get. So where are you from? Where are your parents or your grandparents from? So the question they're asking is, why don't you look like me? Why are you not white? But I remain Unitarian Universalist because I'm a lifelong Unitarian Universalist. I was brought up in this faith, introduced to it at age 2, and I feel the same way about my faith tradition as I feel about living in Texas. I'm a lesbian, I'm Latina, and I'm living in Texas. It's kind of a hostile environment to be both gay and brown. And I choose to stay in both places, Texas and my faith tradition, because, hey, this is my home. And I feel like I'll be damned if I'll leave without a fight. I believe that fighting racism is a spiritual imperative for all of us because the continued existence of racism diminishes our spirit, diminishes our humanity. It's one of the largest reasons that I decided to go this route. I could have gone into nonprofit work or one of the social services fields. But for me, I was very interested in how communities can speak to those deep human yearnings, those spiritual needs, and to do so in community, to organize from that angle. I love this place. You know, for better or for worse, I love my faith tradition, for better or for worse. And there's going to be others who need a way paved. And so I'm in good company. I get strength from knowing that I'm in very good company. There's other people of color and white allies within my tradition who believe in the same goals and who hope to create a truly multicultural, not bicultural, not monocultural, but multicultural faith tradition where no one has to feel like they have to use their elbows and muscle people over to get a seat at the table.
Reverend Marisol Caballero is a minister with the First Unitarian Universalist Church in Austin and the co-vice president of DRUM, a Unitarian Universalist People of Color organization. And that's it for this week, my dear listeners. I hope this finds you all home, safe, and sound with your family and friends. Before we go on, though, I want to let you know about a collaboration between our PBS and World Channel television series, America by the Numbers, with Maria Hinojosa, and the program Teaching Tolerance. We've got curricula designed around 5 of our episodes. So if you're a teacher and you're interested, check it out at tolerance.org/America-numbers. And you can learn more about our television series at AmericaByTheNumbers.org. Check it out and let us know what you think. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Shu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Rodney Hawkins. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr. And you can check out my Instagram. I'll see you at Maria_La_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
These both connected and then something happened and now it fell into my water.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. This is NPR.